Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the New Book Network. I'm Deidre Tyler, host of the channel. Today we'll be talking with L.M. Weeks, author of Bottle Lightning. How are you doing today?
I'm excellent, Deidre. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you. I wonder if you could tell us something about yourself and how you got started with this project.
Well, it's a long story, but I'll try to keep it short. I practiced law for almost 35 years. And I practiced in both New York and Tokyo for quite a long time, representing clients in their, mostly corporate clients in their cross-border acquisitions and intellectual property matters. And over the years, I had in mind this character for a novel, a legal thriller, and finally decided about 5 years ago that if I didn't sit down and write it, I was never going to write it. So I finally sat down and did it.
Well, tell us about Thorn, your major character.
So Thorn, well, there's a famous quote by an author, P.D. James, I think it is, that all fiction is autobiographical and much autobiography is fiction. I'm paraphrasing there. And Thorn is no different. He was based on my experiences practicing law in Japan as an international lawyer. But my son is biracial. His mother is Japanese. And so I decided to make Thorn biracial as well. And I was born in Alaska. So I decided to make him from Alaska, but practicing law in Japan.
Now, you talk about Japanese versus the United States culture in your book. Can you describe something about the differences in working in both of those locations?
Oh, that's interesting. New York, for example, and of course, the U.S. being a very large country, there are some pretty big cultural differences, even within the U.S. For example, Texas is very different from New York, and California is different again from Texas and New York. But in Japan, much of the business is relationship oriented, so it can take quite a while to develop a relationship with a client. But once you have developed that relationship, clients tend to be very loyal. But there's also a burgeoning startup culture in Japan. And so you've got quite a few innovative smaller companies that are growing. And it's really a good thing to see.
Policing in Japan, how is this different
Well, that's a really good question. It is. There's some pros and cons. You have a very sophisticated bar and very good judges who tend to be impartial. On the one hand, on the other hand, the police can hold you for up to 23 days without charging you, and they can also interrogate you without a lawyer. Although things are changing, and more recently they've been allowing your defense attorney to join you in the interrogations. But still, at this point, they can hold you for more than 3 weeks and interrogate you. And that results in most convictions being based upon confessions. Now, that's true in the U.S. as well, but for different reasons, because, as you know, in the U.S., basically people must be charged and either released or held without bail within 24 hours.
Now, the interrogation that Thorne went through, there was really a good description there about it in your book. Can you tell us how he got released without telling us all the story?
Well, he was fortunate because his lawyer is a former prosecutor, and she was able to, and he's also a well-known lawyer in Japan. He's admitted to practice in both New York and Japan. And so she was able to convince the police and the prosecutor with whom she had a relationship when she worked as a prosecutor that Thorne was not a flight risk. And also the police got Thorne to agree that to give up his passports and not leave the country without their permission.
Japanese Americans, how do they deal with mixed race families? Are there some special challenges here?
Well, you're sort of betwixt and between. Whether you're in Japan or in the U.S., I think it's easier in the U.S. I think my son living in Japan, for example, he was always trying to prove that he was just as Japanese as the Japanese, and it's really a difficult task. Either people say, "Well, you're not really Japanese because you're one of your parents is not Japanese," or you are Japanese, so you should know better. I know a lot of people who are mixed race from different countries. Half French, for example, half Japanese, half American, half Japanese. And a lot of them tend to sort of live in this, in a very interesting world that allows them to slip back and forth between, say, the United States and Japan, like a shapeshifter. And my son, for example, can come into New York and immediately transform into New Yorker and realizes how to act, and it's second nature. And it's the same when he's in Japan.
You talk about connection, and I thought this was interesting. Do you think that biracial people connect with other biracial people on a different level?
I think so, because that's actually quite a good question. I think it's because their experiences are quite unique and to them, and there's not a lot of those kinds of people, although the number of biracial people throughout the world is increasing, and I think it is the future. I think it's a very positive development. But they sort of have their own code, and only other biracial people can really relate to what they're going through.
Why is it so important to have a cultural background and experience to write a believable story?
Well, it's a good question. You need to have that that sensitivity to the subject matter, and I think that's, you know, one reason there's that axiom that you should write what you know, because it does resonate, I think, with readers when it's, you know, it's true. And even though I've spent more than half of my adult life living and working in Japan. I myself am not biracial, even though my son is. So I actually had the book read by some beta readers who were biracial before I published it. And I thought I had got most of, if not everything, right. But they still had some very helpful comments that elevated, I think, to a next level of realism.
You also talk about renewable energy and technology. How did you do that research?
Oh, that's a good question. So I decided that I wanted the technology to be some form of renewable energy, but I didn't know what I wanted it to be. And I was actually fishing in the Everglades when we were overtaken by a thunderstorm. And so we had to hunker down and we couldn't get to land. We had to hunker down in the bottom of the skiff out on the water while these giant lightning bolts dropped all around us. And I thought, wow, there's a lot of energy in that lightning. And when I got home, I did some research on it and found out that science knows the theory as to how lightning is generated, but not the actual nuts and bolts, the mechanics of how it's generated. And I thought that's very interesting. There's a gray area that I can work in. And lightning is also very cinematic and exciting. And so I thought if somebody could actually figure out a way to generate it on demand in a clean way that's scalable, so you could use it at your home all the way up to a giant power plant, that could solve our energy and climate change issues.
You also have a lot of description about motorcycle riding. Tell us about your experience of motorcycle riding.
Well, that's a passion of mine. And as an aside, my editor at one point in time, his comment was less motorcycle fetishness. So I actually ended up cutting quite a bit of it before we published the book. But I started motorcycle riding in Japan in the early 80s. And over time, I sort of moved up the chain from mopeds to finally, at one point in time, I had a 1600cc Kawasaki Vulcan, and then later on this BMW 1200 called a K1200 LT, which is just a wonderful motorcycle. And Japan is perfect for riding motorcycles because they have great roads and a lot of them are mountainous and they're very windy and beautiful countryside. And people are, even car drivers are taught to watch out for motorcycles. So it's like the perfect place to drive. Lots of different landscape, seascapes, and driving in the city is also interesting because it's very busy. And I just love it. There are obviously risks, but it's very exciting.
You also have romance in your book. Tell us about the three ladies in the book.
So the main character Torn is an excellent lawyer, and he understands business quite well, and he's bilingual, biracial, bicultural. He's the perfect lawyer to have in Japan. He's running the office of the Tokyo office of a global law firm, and working on for a lot of technology companies. But he's got some relationship issues and some commitment issues. And so he's juggling three quite interesting women. And it's one of the underlying themes of the book is him trying to address this major personal flaw that he has.
Now, the wife dies. Tell us about his reaction to that.
So he was trying to get out of that relationship for quite a while. And because of the laws in Japan, which are unlike the laws in the U.S., they're not no fault divorce laws. He
could not get out of that that marriage because, Yukie, his wife, wouldn't grant him the divorce. But she's the mother of his children, and they were married for quite some time, and so he has a very he's obviously very saddened by it, and he also feels responsible for it to a certain extent.
Now, once she was murdered, tell us about the culture of funerals in Japan.
So it's a fascinating subject for me because and I've been to funerals, unfortunately, in both Japan and the U.S., and they're really quite different. The ones in Japan, I would say, are more like an Irish or a Jewish funeral. They're more in your face. The body is often lying in state at the home. There's no embalming. They just use dry ice. And typically the funeral happens pretty quickly and the burial happens pretty quickly after the person passes away. But they also 99% of the time end up cremating the body. And that's you don't just hand it over to the body to the funeral home and come back and they give you the urn. You're actually there during that process. And so the wake is very sort of in your face in the sense that the body is lying in state in the house and people come and go and bring food and people often sit around the body and sometimes even talk to the person and talk about the person while they're drinking and eating. And then at the crematorium, typically after everybody gathers and they push the casket with the body into the furnace of the crematorium, then you go upstairs and eat while you're waiting for the cremation to be done. And it's just really sort of a surreal process, particularly coming from the U.S.
Now, you talk about the bone ceremony. Tell us a little about that.
Yeah, that's a weird one and very heart-wrenching, particularly if you're close to the person. So they slide the body is put on this plate and they slide that into the furnace. And then after the cremation is done, they slide it out and only the bones are left. And then the family goes through two by two with chopsticks. And each pair of family members picks up a bone and puts it in the urn. And that's why in Japan, when you're eating, you never hand food from one person to another, from one person's chopsticks to another person's chopsticks. You always put it on the other person's plate. And then the other thing is that typically in people's houses and sometimes at their grave sites, people will bring a bowl of rice with chopsticks and put it in front of the gravesite or in front of the little shrine to that person in the home with the chopstick sticking up and straight up and down out of the rice. And that's why you never at dinner time stick your chopsticks in the rice because it brings back those memories of funerals past.
Now, what's the relationship between Japan, China, and Russia in international law? You talk about that in your book.
I think that the major difference is that in Japan the rule of law actually exists. So there is due process, and it's different from the U.S., but there is due process, and so you do have certain protections from unlawful search and seizure, for example, and you have very professional, by and large, police. Japan is a representative democracy. Like most democracies, it tends to be messy, but it is a democracy. I think the big difference between China and Russia on the one hand and Japan on the other is that while Japan's culture is, I mean, it's very unique, Again, it's still a democracy, whereas China and Russia are both authoritarian, basically dictatorships. And so you don't have due process or real due process. And unfortunately, I've been to both countries, both Russia and China, many, many times. And both are fascinating places. But I think it's much safer from a due process standpoint to be in Japan.
Now, you also talk about the gang culture in Japan. There was a lot of description of that culture. Can you tell us, is that growing or decreasing?
It's actually decreasing because there's been some real crackdowns, and there's been historically different kinds of gangs. So there's been motorcycle gangs that they call Bosozoku, that's really started in the 60s. And as those people aged, they graduated to what are called, these Yankee gangs, which are really sort of over the hill motorcycle gangs. And usually those gangs are pretty, benign. They may take off their exhaust pipes and make a lot of noise. But typically not very dangerous. The Yakuza, on the other hand, used to control a lot of illicit businesses, drug dealing, prostitution, illegal gambling, and legal gambling like pachinko is very popular in Japan. Any gun running they controlled, but there's been a lot of crackdowns over the last 30 years. So it's actually been shrinking consistently since the 1980s.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
You also had that trip to Russia in your book. Tell us about the Russian pilots, the helicopter pilots, and that whole series of how life was or is in Russia. You talk about outhouses.
Yeah, the Russian Far East is like the Wild Wild West, or as we call it, I called it in the book, the Wild Wild East. The Russian Far East is actually east of what they consider to be Siberia. So it's interesting in the sense that it's east, even further east than most of China. But it's like Europe in the east. So you go to the cities there and it's all, for the most part, other than the native, Russians there, it's all Caucasians, or what they call white Russians. But you've got a landmass that's roughly the size of Alaska, Western Canada, and the Northwestern U.S. But it's only got 6 million people in the entire area, whereas right across the border in the first state that crossed the border and also this giant river in China, there's 100 million Chinese right there on the border. So it's this vast wilderness area, perhaps the most wild place on the planet. And since there are very few roads, the only way to get from one place to another is by helicopter. And they're building more roads now, but as a consequence, these helicopter pilots really have a lot of power in the Russian Far East, and they fly these just massive helicopters around to deliver people and goods to different places.
How prevalent is stealing technology?
That happens, has happened a lot. And there's a long history of that going back to basically forever since humans started inventing things. But if you go back in history to the 19th century, the U.S. was accused of stealing, for example, railroad technology from from the UK. And then after World War II, there was a fair amount of, shall we say, adoption of technology by the Japanese. Many US companies would call it stealing or trade secret theft. And then when the Chinese adopted, after they adopted capitalism in the 1980s, they started forcing technology transfers from foreign companies coming into China to do business. And in addition to the forced technology transfers, some Chinese companies actually engaged in outright trade secret misappropriation. I even had clients who had research facilities in countries outside of China that suffered trade secret theft by employees that were hired by Chinese companies to steal some technology and transfer it to them. So it's been rampant, to be honest. I don't think that should be a surprise to anybody, but yeah, there's been a lot of it over the decades.
So do you believe that there are countries or companies that will be willing to murder someone just to get this technology?
I would not put anything past when it comes to that kind of technology. So when you've got a technology that's going to completely change the way people generate electricity, and that would, for example, basically destroy the oil and gas industry and or nuclear power and or all other existing renewable energy, such as wind and solar, I would not put it past somebody to engage in homicide to prevent the destruction of, you know, multi-billion dollar businesses. And it's not just corporations, but as you mentioned, there's a lot of countries such as Saudi Arabia, Russia, the United States, for that matter, Venezuela, Iran, Iraq, that have huge stakes in the oil and gas industry, countries in West Africa. And for them to lose, you know, that income stream would just be a disaster for their economies. So I wouldn't put it past, given the interest involved, I wouldn't be surprised if that happened at all.
Now, how does your fishing hobby tie into the climate change aspect of your novel?
Well, I didn't really write much, even though I am a fly fishing fanatic, write much about fishing in the book. I think there's one small reference, but it definitely, I have noticed it, the impact that climate change has had on fisheries in different places, including Alaska and the Pacific Northwest, but Japan as well, and even the Florida Keys. So it's another indication of how the climate is changing.
Now, you had a little brief episode of an earthquake. How did that tie into your book?
So I was actually in Japan on March 11, 2011, when the giant Fukushima earthquake happened that ended up, you know, the tsunami ended up damaging the Fukushima nuclear power plant that ended up melting down. So I was in the office when that happened, and it lasted for over 6 minutes. And one point in time, I thought our building, which is relatively new, might actually fall over. And it was just such a, the aftermath, the people leaving. So many non-Japanese left the country the next day because they were worried about the nuclear fallout from the power plant, the nuclear power plant in Fukushima. And in the town, which is usually a bustling, very busy sort of 24/7 go-go city, turned into this ghost town where, you know, if there were zombies walking around, I wouldn't have been surprised. It was just very surreal. Even a lot of Japanese left and went south or west because of their concerns about radiation. So it was just something that really had a huge impact on me. And I thought would be an interesting scene because it's also earthquakes and tsunamis are just a part of living in Japan. They happen quite frequently. The entire country, for the most part, is on fault lines. And there's hot water wherever you go, almost in the country, there's hot water very close to the surface, which means you have great natural hot water, you know, hot springs, but that's because of all of the volcanic activity that's right under the surface.
What is the message you would like the reader to leave with once they finish your book?
Oh, that's a good question. I think that, the thing about Torn that he represents is a very flawed human who is called upon to do great things, for the benefit of others. And also that things are not always what they seem.
Well, I've taken up enough of your time. What is the next project you'll be working on?
I'm actually working on a novel right now that's not even a legal thriller. It's a contemporary novel about tournament fly fishing in the Florida Keys.
Wow, we'll be looking forward to that book. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.